Why is Diane on my mind? What does it take to lead in America today? For decades, David Gergen had a front row seat to power in the U.S. He worked as an advisor in the White House to Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton. In the late 90s, he took what he learned to the Harvard Kennedy School, founding the Center for Public Leadership. He says the country is in a dark place now, but his time supporting the leaders of tomorrow gives him hope. In a new book, he draws on his own experience in Washington, his decades as a trusted voice on national issues, and years of mentoring young people to offer a playbook for the next generation. His book is titled Hearts Touched with Fire, How Great Leaders Are Made. He joined me on Thursday morning, days after his 80th birthday. First, David Gergen, I want to wish you a happy 80th birthday. Congratulations.
You're so kind. Thank you. Wasn't one I looked forward to, but I'm enjoying it nonetheless.
I understand very well. In your book, you compare our country to a car speeding blindly toward a cliff. What's the threat you feel like we're not paying enough attention to?
Well, I think the largest threat we have right now is in the climate, and because irreversible damage may come here in just the next few years, and we seem so ill-prepared to make the decisions that really put us on a good course. You know, Ukraine has only complicated that because, you know, there's now been a push to have more fossil fuels, reliance upon fossil fuels, and this is a decisive period we're entering now, a decisive decade, and we don't seem to be preparing ourselves well for it. Of course, there are many other crises, but I think the one that I think is sort of ongoing is the crisis in our politics. You cannot solve big problems. You can't get big things done in an environment that's so poisonous and so partisan. And it's gotten progressively worse, not better. And it's a serious threat. Michael Porter at the Harvard Business School conducted a big study of American competitiveness against China, India, Russia, and many more. And what he discovered was if you look at the economic factors that go into competitiveness, we're doing well on that innovation, spirit of innovation. The people are bringing jobs back home and that sort of thing. But what is really stopping us and blocking our growth and our takeoff is our politics. It's the economics would be fine but alone, but the politics, you know, jeopardize everything. So I don't think we know, I don't think we fully appreciate how much we've slipped from where we were. And it's become normal for us to have as much lying as we do from top officials at a very time when the public has lost so much trust in our leaders and in our institutions.
And why do you think that has happened?
Why has it happened? Well, I honestly believe that politics does move somewhat in cycles. And there was a period of time when I first came to Washington, I think maybe around the time you were here, the World War II generation was running the show. We had seven presidents from Jack Kennedy through George H.W. Bush, Democrat and Republican. We had seven presidents in which every single person wore a military uniform. They served in one way or another, served the country when they were young. And that shaped their lives. They came out of that experience feeling we ought not just save the world, we ought to save this country as well. And they gave themselves up to good governance. They weren't perfect as a generation. You know, they did give us, after all, Vietnam and Watergate. But if you look at the totality of what they did when the World War II generation left the stage, the United States was the strongest country since ancient Rome in its economy, in its military, in its culture, and in all sorts of measurements. We were in great shape coming out of that, and we had a can-do spirit. You know, we had a president who said we can go to the moon, and we did it in less time than he said. Our universities were so successful. There were just so many things going on. we turn the world over, basically, or we turn the governance over to the baby boomers. And there are many fine individuals who have been baby boomers. We should not, you know, downgrade them in that sense. But I do think that the period of governance, which started in the early 90s, has been very disappointing. The baby boomers are leaving behind an America that is beset by crises, and it is doesn't seem to be able to pull itself out. And we're growing a gerontocracy to help govern the country, which I think is a mistake. So I have fears that we've gone in the wrong direction. We're on an unsustainable path, and I'm pessimistic about the short term. I think the next few years are going to be very rough. But Diane, I'm increasingly optimistic about the long term. You know, when you look over the horizon at what's out there, there's so many good things starting to happen in our society that I think we can welcome, and should give us hope about the future. I speak particularly of the younger generations. I think, you know, going forward, I think it's time for Generation X, the generation that came between the World War II and the millennials. It's always felt it was being sandwiched, that it hasn't had its time at bat. It deserves its time at bat in the short term. The next few years are really critical. But for long-term purposes, we need to be focused on the millennials and the Generation Z. They're the ones who are going to be in control over the long haul. And I am very encouraged by the veterans who are coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan. And they remind me so much of the World War II generation. Mm. They're serious. Many of them have faced enemy fire. They've hardened up as individuals. They're much tougher than they were. You know, nothing can be tougher than what they've already experienced. And they want to change America at home. And I see all sorts of them volunteering to run for public office, anywhere from city hall or the school board, all the way up to running for Congress.
But at the same time, yesterday's vote against allowing the states to continue to regulate abortion went down. And there wasn't a single Republican who voted for it. In fact, two Democrats voted against it. So it would seem that political divide is what is stalling us on these issues that you're so concerned about, on climate change, for example, on the way inflation is working. It would seem that they're at odds on everything. And how can a country move forward in that climate?
I think we're undergoing a certain amount of paralysis now because of it. And Diane, the truth of the matter is it may get worse before it gets better. In terms of capacity to get things done, that is, if in the midterm elections, if the House is turned back over to the Republicans, you're going to have them blocking Biden at every turn. And it's going to be very difficult for Biden to govern. I do think there are going to be some people who will want to do it in a bipartisan way. But the truth of the matter is, after the midterms, if Republicans sense there's blood in the water and they've taken over the House, they're going to spend the next 2 years trying to ensure that Biden or the Democrats don't get credit for anything, and they get blocked on a lot of things. So I don't mean to be a total pessimist, but I do believe that we're heading for some real problems in these elections.
So after Biden's first 100 days, you likened him to FDR. You praised his performance as a leader in the hard times. What about his leadership now?
I was encouraged after the first few months of the Biden administration. I thought I was attracted to his own internal resilience and the way he came through crucibles when his wife and a child were killed, and then he lost his son, Beau. And I thought, one of the things that's remarkable about this man is how he's bounced back himself, and he's kept his cool. And I thought, that he's got some inner strengths. He's softer on the outside than he is on the inside in some ways. And so I admired that. I thought he was honestly trying to, make this a better world.
Yes.
And somehow it hasn't lived up to its early promise. And I'm not quite sure we'll know why. I do believe that he tried to do too much too soon. And what happened was they got a garbled message out. It wasn't clear what they believed in or what their main priorities were. He simplified it since, and I think he's doing better now than he was doing. But he's been so far down in the cellar for so long, it's really, really hard to come back, especially with this inflation still raging. I know it eased up just a bit here in the last few days, but it's still raging.
How much do you believe his low ratings are because of what he's done, and how much is because the Republicans in Congress have blocked everything he's tried to do?
I think that there are a lot of Republicans in Congress who have now succumbed to the Trump virus, and they they are doing everything they can to ensure that the Democrats aren't reelected. It's all about the power game that's going on here, and that's very unfortunate. We used to have. We've always had politics that have interfered with our governance, but this politics seemed to come and go. We had elections that people got transfixed for a few weeks, but then we went back to doing things and got back to normal pretty quickly. We haven't had a normal, anything we would consider a normal for a long time now, and the blood is in the water. I think that the Republicans sense they could really deliver some knockout blows here. And the Democrats are searching for answers. And I think the country may be basically ungovernable for 2 or 3 years.
Really? What do you mean ungovernable?
In a sense that the whatever agenda Biden has is going to a very large extent going to be put on hold if the midterms give power back to the Republicans. Now, Republicans will celebrate that. They would say, yes, that's the will of the country. That's what politics are all about. That's what democracy is all about. I think the Democrats have a strong case to make on this approval rating, Diane, that the Republicans have spent a lot of time arguing and getting agreement from their base that Trump was not fairly elected. Trump was unfairly treated in the elections. And the big lie has taken hold. So you've got 30 or 40% of your people right there, right from the beginning, who believe that Biden is illegitimate. So it doesn't leave as much of a group for him to go to rebuild his own base to get up closer to 50%. And as you know, 50% is often conventionally regarded as the magic number for presidential approval heading into midterms. If you're below 50%, your party tends to lose a number of seats. If you're above 50%, you can protect yourself. So here we got a guy, a president, who's in the low 40s.
At best. So the question becomes, with the leak on the Supreme Court regarding abortion, what kind of effect, if any, do you think that could have on the midterms?
We'll have to wait and see how this decision comes down. There are rumors in Washington from well-placed sources that Justice Roberts may go the other way before this is over, that it would be, instead of a 5-4 court, it would be a 6-3 court on the conservative side. I see no prospect of Roe v. Wade surviving this court session. I do think it's a question of what the numbers look like. The leak is much more destructive than I think people fully understand, because it really, we're now moving into what could be the heavy politicization of the courts. And it's bad enough when you go through these approval processes and, you know, what we've seen and McConnell and that sort of thing these last few years has already lowered approval and lowered expectations from a lot of Americans about the courts. But I think if we move now to this leak sort of showing us inside the decision-making process, and that it will be painted as a bunch of politicians, you know, sort of railing against the courts and trying to sabotage the courts, in effect, or take them hostage, I think that's going to be very destructive.
What What do you think that President Biden would have to do to reassert himself in time for those midterm elections?
Well, I think if he could do two things, and neither looks very, it looks within easy range. But first of all, I think if you can get the price of gasoline down to $3 a gallon instead of $4.37 or whatever the number is, I mean, it's astonishing you go into, you know, get your car filled up with gas and you get a $60 bill.
Exactly.
It is sort of a shocker. And so I do think bringing inflation down, but you have to do this carefully. You know, Paul Volcker, whom I thought was an excellent head of the Federal Reserve, he had much worse inflation to bring down. And he had the support of President Reagan. You know, Jimmy Carter was the one who nominated Volcker, but Reagan reappointed him, a person from the other party. But he did that because Volcker was so wonderfully successful at bringing down the rate of inflation and making the short-term recession sharp. Unemployment went up quickly, but it settled back down quickly. And when Reagan went on, because I think Paul Volcker did a major service for the country, we've had inflation under control under Volcker and into the current time until just recently, and it's become a very recent kind of thing. So that's one, is that, and I think second, if you get a some sort of resolution in Ukraine, which doesn't involve Americans, there's going to be a sense that Biden helped to pull this off. But again, it doesn't look like that's going to become, it looks unlikely, but those are the kinds of things you'd want to see.
Do you agree with Larry Summers that the interest rate should have gone up sooner, like last summer?
I think Larry Summers has been more than vindicated. And, you know, people were dumping on him within the Democratic Party, and they thought he was out of bounds and out of control. And it turned out he was right. And that it's almost now common wisdom that the New York Times just had a big story in the last few days, that the Fed acted too late. And there's also this question of whether too much money was voted on at the same time and whether that fueled inflationary fears. But there are other elements, obviously, supply chain things. And, you know, you have to be, in fairness to Biden and the Democrats, this is not all they're doing. But in fairness to the Republicans, the Democrats did have something to do with it.
And COVID. I mean, COVID stepped in totally unexpectedly.
What's concerning here is that this cascade of crises that we are experiencing. I can't remember any period, possibly the New Deal, but we weren't around for that, in which there was so much coming at us so fast, and it's been so hard to get on top of it.
I agree.
And it's almost as if it's more than we can handle. I would bet that if the Democrats lose the midterm elections in the House, there's going to be sort of a reckoning within the White House itself about it, and in order to get prepared for the next couple of years. I imagine there may be some sort of shakeup in the White House.
You mean of the group at the top?
Yeah. If there were a couple of heavyweights he could bring in, they would stabilize people's expectations, or at least, I think one of the people that's made me comfortable, and I think made many others comfortable, is Janet Yellen. I think she's been a star in the cabinet, and she gives you confidence that the cabinet, that the Treasury is in good hands. I think we need a little more of that now in the other parts of the administration, a couple of the other places in the administration.
I spoke over the weekend to someone I won't name who is in the administration in one of the divisions. He argued that the people around Joe Biden, as well as the president himself, have created a mess of leadership. Do you agree with that?
A mess in leadership? Well, I don't have the inside story, and I don't have enough facts. I do know that the current chief of staff of the White House, I think they run clean. I spent some time with him early on. He asked me to come in and talk, and I came away impressed. A very smart guy, has been around, paid his dues, and I continue to believe has a lot to offer. But I do think that the administration would benefit. I think if they had a couple of heavyweights to come in, I do think it would help.
Like who?
Well, at that point, yeah, that's a very good question. Where do you turn to find that kind of help? You know, the Tom Daschles of the world, where I think you would normally turn. I think Tom Daschle is, you know, I think he's a first rate political leader. I also think the Democrats need to get some fresh blood in the ranks. You know, as I mentioned, this idea of a gerontocracy, and you know, there are a lot of Democrats in those top slots who are 75, 80 years old. And to think that if Trump and Biden are the two nominees of the party, the next president is going to be someone who governs when they're in their 80s. That is risky from my point of view. I think the country would be better served if we didn't have 80-year-olds running the country. I don't know how you feel about that, Diane.
I totally agree with you. And this gentleman I spoke with over the weekend in the administration said he hoped, as I hope, that Biden does not run again.
Yeah, that's where I am. My sense is he's a fine person, and he has many, many strong attributes. I just think when you're in your 80s, you just miss a step.
Absolutely.
In my experience, I'm not as clear as I once was in my judgment. I'm not as fast on the trigger. My memory is, you know, a little hazier. It's not that I'm incapacitated. It's just that I shouldn't be running a big organization. And the presidency.
I hope he feels that.
I would like to believe that. I think it would be doing his country a favor. And I think he, you know, it's a bit of a self-sacrifice, but he's, you know, you and I have just been talking about this. It's important not to run away from your age and deny your age. It's important to embrace it.
Exactly.
And make the most of it. And I think there are many good things that people in their 80s can continue to do. They can be sages. They can be mentors. They can be philanthropists. They can help out with nonprofits. They can look after grandchildren. There are a lot of good things that people can do. And in their 80s, it really serves society well. But you shouldn't take on the things that, you know, that are dangerous. You know, Woodrow Wilson in his second term, he had a stroke in the last couple of years, and he was totally incapacitated. His wife ran the country. It was a mess.
Yeah.
And those were simple times. Today, if something like that happened, I don't know, we'd be in a semi-crisis, and we wouldn't know what to do, and we'd be looking at ourselves and say, I just can't believe we let ourselves do this.
Now a quick break. When we return, the rest of my conversation with David Gergen.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with David Gergen. His new book is titled Hearts Touched with Fire. David, you were a Republican. You left the party. What do you think the Republican Party stands for today? Is it Trump's party?
Well, I was registered as independent, but I certainly work for Republicans, so I don't disagree with what your analysis. We've never seen in our lifetimes a person outside the party take the party as hostage, intellectually hostage as Trump has, and it's been a grave disappointment about the Republicans. I think the best way for Donald Trump to leave the stage is to beat him in a few couple of elections. And if he sustains one or two losses, this is going to go away. The aura is going to go away. But I think they're doing long term damage to the party. And I do believe that Nancy Pelosi was right the other day when she said the country needs a center-right party. That doesn't mean a radical party. It means a party that is more inclined toward the capitalistic system, that it believes much, puts more emphasis on smaller government and that sort of thing. But well, just agree, about, but we need a center-left party.
What about people like Mitch McConnell, who on January 6th, where you referenced him, said, you know, Donald Trump really must take responsibility for what's happened here today. Kevin McCarthy, same thing, and yet immediately turning around and taking back what they said.
I know, and saying one thing in public and a different thing in private.
Right.
Yeah, and so you wonder who's the true person here. But I don't think that Mitch McConnell and McCarthy have done themselves any favors by the way they've handled this. And Mitch is another octogenarian that you have to think about, and as well as Nancy and a number of others. But one thing about Mitch McConnell, you have to say, he plays to win, and he wins, and we haven't seen the same skill, frankly, among Senate Republicans as we've seen in McConnell. We find it distasteful what he did on the court, especially. It was distasteful, wrong, I thought. But there seem to be no limits on what some Republicans will do these days in order to cling to power.
And what about Senate Democrats? How do you think they're working?
Well, I think they're well intentioned, but they're not producing results that one would have expected. And you keep wondering, why did they shoot the moon? Try to shoot the moon early on. Why didn't they break this into pieces of economic program? And what we see right now is a White House that seems to be walking away from, or at least not wanting to talk about, you know, its earlier propositions. I thought by now we would see an effort to have one or two or three things passed where they might be able to find bipartisan support. I don't know why they've been so diverted away from that. I thought that you could take that behind the scenes and do some negotiating and come up with something that you could pass and point to. I mean, we left a lot of women and children. You know, that the original bill that went down had a lot about, it could be called the Women and Children's Bill because it did so much for families. Surely there are things there that we could still save and feel good about.
And Joe Manchin, I mean, on every idea that Biden has had, he seems to go the other way.
He does. I have friends on the center right who think that in the long run, Democrats may look back and say, thank goodness we did listen to Manchin. They blocked some of this stuff because it's so expensive. And, you know, it's sort of part of the people who sort of salute Larry Summers for his views on these things. What I don't understand is why Biden and Manchin and maybe a couple of others couldn't sit down and have dinner together a couple of times and work some of this stuff out before you started down this path. If you knew it was going to be, impossible, then why do it? Why put yourself through that and look like you're weak?
To your knowledge, has Biden had a single one-on-one conversation with Manchin?
Not that I'm aware of. And I think that's telling. I do think what you want to try to do in that job, and what the successful presidents find ways to set up friendships or relationships or trust relationships. I mean, for goodness sakes, Ronald Reagan, the most conservative president, got along extremely well with Tip O'Neill, the most liberal Democrat, when O'Neill was running the House. And he remember Reagan had this birthday party for Tip, and I think Tip was turning 65 or 70, and Reagan, at the end of it, got up to make a little toast, and he'd written out some doggerel, as he liked to do, and Reagan said, Tip, if I had a ticket to heaven and you didn't have one too, well, I'd give my ticket back and go to hell with you.
Wow.
That was really spoken, and they had a rule Diane, they had a rule between Tip and Reagan that before 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you could beat the hell out of the other guy. You could take the floor and say the guy's a nincompoop, he's done this, he's done that. But after 5 o'clock, you put down your differences and you didn't go after each other. And you could lift up a glass and they would tell old Irish yarns and laugh and scratch and have a good time. And Tip didn't like Reagan to start with and he didn't trust him for a long time. But eventually they were on the same wavelength and got big things done. They got tax reform done. They got Social Security redone.
So you worked for 4 different presidents. Getting back to your book, you worked as an advisor to Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton. Tell me about their leadership qualities, how they were alike and how they were different, and what we need in a leader today.
Thank you for asking, and I would like to talk about what the message is of the book. But they were different in many ways. I'll shorthand it for you. Nixon was the best strategist I've ever met in public life. He was figuratively able to go up on a mountaintop and look into the past, and from that have a greater insight into what the future was. Churchill believed very much in that theory, and that's why he wrote so many histories as he did. He thought it really helped him try to understand the future. And Nixon, I think, and with Kissinger, he was very successful on the international front, splitting apart China and Russia. I'm afraid today it looked like we're trying to get them back together again, which is a terrible mistake. But nonetheless, the strategist Nixon was excellent. Had that been all there was to Richard Nixon, he would have been one of our better presidents. But of course it wasn't, because he had demons inside him that he had never learned to control. And they eventually took him down. He was an angry man who had numerous grievances. Reminds me so much of Trump in some ways. He just was angry at the world. And he felt politics was the life of the jungle, and you either eat or you're eaten. And he preferred to eat. Nixon was a very complex man who needed to leave office. It was important they do that. Gerry Ford, by contrast, straight as the day is long, he was absolutely trustworthy. He said in his confirmation hearings that trust is what holds us together as a people. And what I found was that people in an organization tend to take their cues from the leader. So that in the Nixon White House, there were a lot of people who thought Nixon was semi-crooked or whatever, and they would do strange and they could bend corners or cut corners and everything, and they wouldn't get caught. With the Ford White House, what you found was, because Ford was so honest, he had the most honest White House I've ever seen. People were quite careful about doing that. And by the way, he had courage, which was not recognized until later, when he pardoned Richard Nixon and cost him the presidency. But, some years later, the John F. Kennedy Library, and it gave its annual award for courage, gave it to Gerry Ford.
Interesting.
The Democratic institution giving paying homage to
Interesting.
Ford. Reagan, I would tell you, his politics were more conservative than mine. I'm pro-choice, for example. Reagan was the best leader of the group. And the best, I think, one of the best leaders the country's had since John Kennedy. There was something about him that was warm and reassuring, and that even if, say, my wife didn't totally disagreed with him, but she liked him, and fair enough, because I think he gave people reassurance. He also had a sense of humor, which I think served him well. And he conducted a White House that I thought was honorable. He went off the tracks with the Iran-Contra affair, but he got himself back on track with David Abshire's help. So it made a difference. But I thought he was, when Charles de Gaulle died, it was said of him that he was great, not because he was in France, but because France was in him. And I think that's true of Reagan. It was he was a very good American president, not because of, he was in America, but because America was in him. And Bill Clinton, frankly, Bill Clinton was the smartest, best I could tell. I could go in the Oval Office and be part of a small group that was talking to him, a very active conversation. He would be, you know, he'd be right engaged in the conversation. And then while you started talking and telling him something, he would be listening, but also filling out a New York Times crossword puzzle. So I was quite in awe of that. Actually, I was insulted.
With good reason. But what about his character as a leader?
Character as a leader, I think you have to distinguish between the public Bill Clinton and the private Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton privately had, you know, was flawed, and he knew that. He was persuaded not to run the first time because he needed to clean up his act. And he was very drawn to women. Women are extremely drawn to him. But so were guys. I mean, you know, seduction was sort of his way of being in the world. And it was very, very successful. But I can just tell you, when my mom was like in her 75 or 80, and she had met Bill Clinton once at a Renaissance group down in Hilton Head, and they had a nice conversation. And she then came to see him 2 years later. I came in to introduce her to him in the Oval Office. He picked right up on the conversation. He could pick right up on where they'd been in their conversation before.
Wow.
And she was wowed by it. You know, she fell in love with the guy.
Yeah.
he was good company. He was funny. He was very human. George Stephanopoulos wrote this book called All Too Human, which I thought was a good memoir of those days. Clinton might have benefited in retrospect from having lost two or three elections instead of one. I think it would have given him more of a sense of not just humility, but how easy it is to lose power. I think he had a sense that he could walk right on the edge of the envelope, and if he fell off, he could talk his way out of it. You know, he could charm anybody, and he had this sense that he could beat the rap. And he, I think, often got bored because he was very smart. I think he often got bored with some of the aspects of the presidency and sort of the chase for women, the chase for adulation, the chase for getting a bill through. He enjoyed the chase.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think he was a better president than he's remembered. I happen to like Bill Clinton a lot.
In the book, you wrote about your own journey. So many people who see and hear you on television, on radio, podcasts, I think they'd like to know how you got your start.
Well, I appreciate that. I'll try not to drag on too long. I grew up in North Carolina, grew up on a dirt road in Durham, we never had much money. My dad bought our house for $9,000, as I recall, there were four boys. My dad was a chair of the math department at Duke for a quarter century, and my mom was a lovely writer, but she had her hands full with the four of us. But in any event, coming from the South very much shaped my life. I wanted to be a ball player, wanted to be a professional ball player. I was a pitcher in the early years in Little League and Pony League and that sort of thing. And I could throw a pretty good pitch. But then between junior high and then the first year of high school, I grew about 6 inches. I just sprouted up like a beanpole. And I lost a lot of my physical coordination. So I went out for the high school baseball team shortly after, because it was raining, we had our first tryouts inside a gym. And so I was pitching to a guy. I started pitching to my catcher, and I threw about three or four balls, and they went pretty well. And then I threw one that I totally lost control over, and that ball went through a window. Wasn't just any window, Diane. It went through a window on the second floor.
Oh, my gosh.
And I knew at that instant that I never had a future in baseball and I should look for some other line of work. So I got into sports writing. And I started working for the local newspaper, the Morning Herald. We had two newspapers. I worked for both. And covering sports. And I would, on Friday nights, I'd go out to Friday night football, and I'd race up and down the sidelines, and during halftime, I'd go up in this rickety old iron stand and go on the radio to talk about what was happening on the field. I was about, you know, I was about 15 years old. And then after the game was over, my dad would drive me to the local news office, where I sat down to a typewriter, and I'd get there about 10:30, and I had until midnight to turn in my copy. And I'd sit there and type out this piece. And I had, you know, a couple of guys had been to Chapel Hill to journalism school who were my mentors, and they were my editors. But it was a great experience. And I started working practically full time when I was about 16 years old. I did newspapers. In 1959, I was on my way to college, and my Durham Morning Herald gave me press credentials to cover Nikita Khrushchev's visit to Washington to see Eisenhower. And I came up, I was on the press bus, and I did all those things.
Wow.
Story. So it was a lot of fun. And I thought that's where I might go eventually, was journalism, because I enjoyed it and it worked out pretty well. But anyway, I spent a long time trying to figure out what I did want to do in life. And I write about this in the book. My most satisfying experience in public life was not in the White House, as you might imagine, although I was honored, and it's a privilege for anybody to work in the White House, so I'm very blessed.
Of course.
But as I look back, what was most satisfying to me in public life was we had a governor, and this is the early 60s, 63, who was Terry Sanford, who was a charismatic. He was our John F. Kennedy. And I went to work for him on civil rights. And he was forming what they call the North Carolina Good Neighbor Council. And he had a fellow who was heading us up who'd been a segregationist, but had converted over. And his name was David Coltrane. And I went and worked for David Coltrane for 4 summers, and I was his staff. He had a secretary, and he had me. And one of the things I did for him was I drove him around the countryside. We went from town to town trying to get leading white citizens to sit down with leading black citizens to work on problems of jobs and of education, but also to keep the peace. Keep the racial peace. That was the summer that Schwerner and Cheney, those three guys, were murdered in Mississippi. So there was great fear about that. But I also remember very, very well, I had a very close friend named Russell Ritchie. We went to high school together. And he was working one summer in a black church. He was an assistant pastor at a black church. And he and I decided to go, and there were four of us eventually, to go to a Klan rally down in southeastern North Carolina. I wanted to see, because I was working on this Good Neighbor Council, I wanted to see what the other side was like. I wanted to see what, you know, what the Klan looked like. Who were these people? And Russell wanted to get a tape recording, audio tape recording, that he could share with his flock back at the church. And so we came rolling in. There were cops everywhere. But as soon as we got close to the field where the KKK was going to be demonstrating, the cops disappeared. And all the regular cops disappeared, and we had a bunch of brown-shirted guys who came up, who were big, burly, heavy, baseball bat kind of guys. And they took one look at us and did not like what they saw. So they took this guy's tape recorder and destroyed it. And then when we went back to our car to get out of there, it was 10 o'clock at night, to get out of there, there was a huge crowd around our car waiting for us to come back there. And we sort of made our way through it, got into the car, and then they started beating up on the car. They were jumping on the roof. They were beating on the window. Yeah, I thought, oh, God, we're never going to get out of here. And they were yelling at us, we're going to teach you never to come back here again. You're not welcome, et cetera, et cetera. And I told the guy who was driving, I said, listen, you got to turn on the ignition and move very slowly, but move. We have to move this car. We have to get out of here. We can't. They're going to kill us if they beat us up very long. And he did, and we gradually made our way to the edges of the thing. And then we got on toward the highway, and then they started chasing us in cars. And we had this big car chase that lasted for a while. And finally, they went away. But it was a scary proposition. But as I look back upon the whole summers that I spent with Dave and with Terry Sanford and people who became very dear friends, it was very meaningful. It was very fulfilling to me, because in government, too often in Washington, you order something or you push a button, but you never see what actually happens on the ground. And here we what was happening on the ground was what was important. And working with those local communities and trying to bring them around, trying to keep them safe, I felt I was doing something that actually had significance to it.
And you were, and local reporters are still trying, but look what's happened to local newspapers.
Absolutely. They have just shells of them. They're so thin. You look at these papers and a lot of them have turned into weeklies, and they're just not getting the kind of good reporting that you really want.
Exactly. Before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say about leadership and where we should be heading?
Yeah, sure. Now, thank you for that question. It gave me a chance to get on my soapbox, if you don't mind, for just a moment or two. I think we're on a path that's unsustainable, is increasingly dangerous, and we very much need to change. One set of people whom I do think need to change are baby boomers. They've been running the country for about 30 years, and there are many fine people, baby boomers, but as a group, they need to pass the baton. The time has come to let younger people have a crack at running the country.
David, just on that baby boomer question, that is precisely why I left the microphone for The Daily Show in 2016. I so very strongly felt that younger people should come forward with their ideas, and that I had a wonderful run, but now somebody else need to bring fresh ideas, fresh thoughts, and that's what you're saying.
I think how we prepare people for the future, for service and for leadership, really for servant leadership, I think is going to determine the path of the country, whether we go up or whether we go down.
David, thank you so much.
I'm so, so pleased to be with you.
That was David Gergen, CNN analyst and founder of the Harvard Center for Public Leadership. His new book is titled Hearts Touched with Fire, How Great Leaders Are Made. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Bent Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rains.